Welcome to Us with Dr. Crystal Lee Crane, a show for people with open hearts and who care about justice. Real change takes root in our values and actions. I encourage my guests and listeners to lean into what it means to be stewards of justice, hope, and liberation. Rooted on the promise of self-determination, your host, Dr. Crystal Lee Crane, engages in questions about human rights, spiritual and political problems, and the ever-present need to protect our planet. Choose liberation with Dr. Crystal Lee Crane and unite together so we can learn from one another and respect each other as experts of our own realities. Here in this show, we will have critical conversations about social justice issues, as well as the challenges and opportunities that build our collective capacity to thrive and coexist. In each episode, we will learn from our guests about their work, how they create, love, and live. With me, Dr. Crystal Lee Crane, take a part in uniting and positively changing communities, the country, and the world. Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Crystal Lee Crane, and you're listening to us on Transformation Talk Radio. Stay with us as we hear from Shonda Rani Jha and learn about anti-oppressive practices, the role of faith in social change efforts, and personal and professional strategies to thrive in our complex and ever-changing social fabric. Hi, dear heart. Nice to see you and hear you.
So good to see you.
I've been playing with different ways to introduce folks on the show. And so this is my second time doing it, but I want to share some things that people have said about you. And so I won't claim like super creative license because it came from your website, but I love it.
I love it.
I'll tell on myself. But the first one goes, they dealt with issues of differences, tolerance and respect in a gentle and inspiring way. Mm-hmm. They've helped us tell our stories and listen to the stories of our sisters. Mm-hmm. And that made me happy because it made me feel like there was a description of the way in which I feel like you hold hearts.
Yes,
my love. And then the second one is, I greatly appreciate their contributions and activism among the South Asian diaspora communities on social justice issues, particularly as it relates to cross-cultural communication, racial, gender, and sexual rights.
Wow. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, we've known each other a minute.
Over a decade at this point.
Yes, well over a decade. And we met through our activism work and our organizing work, which is a very big part of our lives, but there's so many other ways that we spend our time.
Yep.
Which doesn't disconnect them, right? But they're all connected. So can you share with our listeners about how you spend your time, love?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess technically my profession is as a diversity, equity, and inclusion consultant. But in a lot of ways, that work emerges out of decades of community organizing. Mostly racial justice, worker justice, housing justice have been the arenas that I've done that. And I also spend an awful lot of my time in spiritual spaces. I'm an ordained pastor in the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, but I was raised by a Scottish Presbyterian mother and a Hindu father. And so the interfaith world, the multi-faith world, is definitely where I feel most at home.
I love that. So like when you say interfaith world, I have a vision in my head. You know, I worked with the American Friends Service Committee.
Yes.
As an interfaith organizer, I mean, 2006. I mean, it was a while ago. But like, well, how do you define it? How do you define interfaith?
Yeah. So it's interesting because I feel like a lot of people are shifting to multi-faith because, and that's a newer shift, right? And at first I was like, it's just semantics. And then I started realizing, oh, the reason for that shift is interfaith implies that we kind of are merging together in some way, whereas multi-faith acknowledges each of us brings something distinct that's valuable. We don't want to replicate that dangerous melting pot myth, right? Even in the religious yeah. community. And so I love this vision for, and it aligns with a lot of the organizing work I do. I work out of a model of organizing called faith-rooted organizing. And the idea of that is each of us is bringing the best of our traditions into the work of organizing in a pretty horizontal way. And in a way that isn't trying to flatten things or play to the lowest common denominator, mm-hmm. But to each bring our distinct gifts that make the movement richer.
I love this idea of multi-faith because as someone who, you know, I say I was quote unquote raised atheist, meaning I just wasn't raised with any religion. So maybe I was just raised agnostically. But then I found Buddhism on my own.
Yes.
And, you know, there's not a lot of Black girls from Flint, Michigan finding Buddhism these days. But I had different influences. I think going to CIS had something to do with that. But like, you know, that's where I found resonance for the message. And the resonance of that message is what hit my heart. And so when I think of multi-faith basis, like I think about how we're actualizing our values in our heart and where we feel seen. And it's not in contradiction to anyone else's existence.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And that there's space for each of them. It's something that I thought about, you know, there was one point where I think you might remember my co-pastor for life, Tyomri Span Wilson. He was raised Quaker and he is a priest in the Ifa tradition. Now he was recently kind of brought into that formally, which is one of the Nigerian ancestral traditions. Mm-hmm. So Tyomri and I were talking about starting a church together, and we got a lot of pushback from the like denomination. They were like, right, it sounds like you're creating a church for people who don't necessarily want to become Christian. And we're like, right. you know, like there's some people for whom Islam is going to be the deepest way they connect to the sacred, right? Like I have friends who are like, I was out of control, and Islam is translates to like discipline, to kind of like following this structure and order. I'm not saying that's how all Islam shows up, but like for some of my friends, they were like, I would still be in jail or I would be dead if it weren't for Islam. And like, if that's how someone connects to the sacred, that's amazing. We want to connect them with that. If someone is resonating deeply with Buddhism, then that's where they should be, right? Like that's a multi-faith movement at its best is when, and you know, for me, Jesus has been my best friend since I was 3 years old. Right? I was raised with deep appreciation for Hinduism. I have like, there are, you know, Hindu deities all over my apartment that have been gifted to me or that resonate with me. My family in India considers me to be part of that tradition, even though they know I'm a Christian minister. And yeah, for me, I've had someone I could turn to when I felt completely alone, when I felt like nobody understood me. Jesus was hanging out there with me. And so that's what's resonated for me. I love that there's all these different paths.
And we aren't necessarily, unless we are, you know, blessed with like families that have diverse perspectives of experience and understandings of ways of being in the world. Like there was only good religions or good faith practices and then bad ones.
Yep.
And then there's like, you know, there's nothing in between and you just had to believe in God as if that was, and I often don't talk about like Christianity and like God in the sense, but in this conversation, not that I'm like uncomfortable with it, but it's more so like, I think people don't understand that while I have an affinity for Buddhism, I have an affinity for, like you said, the sacred.
Yeah.
And I see it in people.
Yeah.
Regardless, one of my best friends, we've been friends for 25 years and we met each other when I was 14 years old.
Oh.
And she loves Jesus. And, you know, I remember her being like, come to church with me. I was like, that's cool. Yeah, I'll go. You know, like, and she's like, no, it also goes. I was like, it doesn't bother me. Like, unless they were like spewing hate or something.
Right.
But they just wanted to sing and dance and hold hands, you know, like, and I was I love being together.
Like, that version of Christianity is all right.
Yeah. Don't try me with a good time. You want to be together and hang out and like have a good vibe. I'm with it. And a part of it that I think while, you know, my friend and I, we didn't have the language for it then that we do now is this idea of values and personal agency that we both had very strong in our like bone marrow.
Yes.
That was like, this is how I feel. This is what I know to be true.
Yeah.
And this is how I'm going to engage in the world.
Absolutely. I do have to say, I mean, So it's interesting because I'm dating somebody who is trans and who is not religious. And, you know, if I were an Arab American trans man, I would have a very healthy distrust of institutional religion as well. And he was saying sometimes he'll and most of his network is, you know, queer activists, you know, QTPOC folks, right? And queer and trans people of color. And he said sometimes he'll mention to somebody, yeah, I'm dating someone who is technically a pastor. And I think he says technically because like my work is actually mostly in secular spaces. And he's a little weirded out by this. And he said, when I mention it to people, they're like, I don't understand. Is the person you're dating like self-hating or something? Because they know that I'm, you know, queer, that I'm non-binary. And it just wigs them out a little bit. And I think that's because as much as I've gotten from my relationships with people of faith and from my faith itself, right, in the worst times of my life, that same religion has done a ton of harm. A lot of religions have done a ton of harm to people who were already on the margins. And I think it's important to acknowledge that and to really respect the fact that for some people, religion will always be an unsafe place. And I get that.
Yeah, I mean, in my interfaith organizing days, I remember standing face to face with the Westboro Baptist Church.
Yep.
While I was on the Michigan peace team. And so they standing between the protesters.
Yep.
You know, I could technically at that point have said I've been spit on. And so like it was like, you know, they're trying to do the play. I can't remember the name of the play.
Westboro Baptist was trying to do the play?
No, they were protesting.
Oh, they were protesting the play.
About Matthew Shepard.
Oh,
and right. I remember, this was in Kalamazoo, Michigan, like years ago. And I just remember thinking like, what I know of God is love.
Yep.
And what I know of like the true expression of values that don't cause harm. And it doesn't come from just one place.
Yeah.
And so and this is something we have in common, but it's like the work that you do around anti-racist practices and anti-racist philosophies, how do you see that connection? How do you see that playing out in your understanding and growth?
Yeah. And I think what you're talking about being a part of a group that was committed to peacemaking, to nonviolence. Mm-hmm. And I know that nonviolence can be used tactically. I know that people in the U.S. freedom movement sometimes only used it tactically. And some, you know, some of them, it was just a tactic. And for others, it was a way of life, which also connects in many ways to the way I do organizing, the way I've seen you do organizing. And it's another place where I get why people don't do it. I get why people are like, there is a point at which you have to meet force with force. And for me, I've found that I can stay in the work better when I am doing my best to tap into what is sacred about the other person, even when they cannot see the sacred or even the humanity in me. I've found that that has been soul-saving work. It's been what's kept me in the work and kept me from burning out. Mm-hmm. And to me, that spiritual work, although I work with people who don't identify as spiritual, who are deeply committed to the same thing. So it's funny because the first time I encountered the Westboro Baptist Church was 2001, and they were protesting my denomination, the Christian Church Disciples of Christ. We were doing a joint gathering with the United Church of Christ. Those are both denominations that have been LGBT affirming for a long time, which is why the Westboro Baptist Church showed up at our gathering in Kansas City to protest and to say horrible, hateful, violent things.
Yeah.
And the youth at that conference, who were pretty much to a person active in LGBT rights work, they went outside of the convention hall and took bottles of cold water to the people at the Westboro Baptist Church protest.
Because
they were like, it's hot, it's humid, you've been out here all day, you must be suffering, so here's some cold water. And to me, that was just the embodiment of the best of who we can be. And it didn't involve them compromising any part of what they believed. In fact, it was inviting the folks from Westboro to be better than they were trying to be.
Right. And it's that whole idea about, like, people tell you who they are, but we have to remember that we're people too.
That's right.
And
That's right.
we are creating and crafting and shaping the narrative of who we are as individuals, the communities we come from, the places in which we inhabit. All of those things are stories. All of those things are
Yes.
things that we either perpetuate, shift, and change to be in our most just and high benefit, or we, and everything in between, or we utilize it to be a weapon. And the weaponization of values is something that is not new,
Right.
especially in for faith communities, which I think you're, talking about that harm you were saying.
Yeah.
But I think that one of our greatest kind of lessons and wins that we could have moving forward is bridging this divide between multi-faith spaces and secular spaces.
Yes.
Because we are speaking the same
That's
language,
right.
as someone who dabbles like you in both.
Yep.
And the power of collective understanding
Yeah.
and knowing that we are familiar, like, and
Yes.
this is not optional, my love for you.
Yes.
I don't so but that sounds out of this world to some people,
Yeah.
right?
No,
Like,
I totally agree. So I was a part of this campaign. We were trying to get, well, we won. This was a huge victory. We got union track jobs for Black and Brown West Oakland residents at the former West Oakland Army base. It was a years-long campaign. We took on the largest international developer, so the largest developer in the world in order to win this. And it was a coalition, and it was West Oakland youth organizations and environmental organizations and community organizations and labor, like unions, all coming together to demand that our city not sell us cheap, right? We wanted a West Oakland where people who have been there for generations could benefit from what was going on in our own neighborhood. And instead of getting pushed out because of it, right? It's a huge campaign. And the developer was wicked smart, right? They went directly to the most powerful group within that coalition, which was the unions, and they said, "We will give you everything you want if you will walk away from this coalition." And I'm not going to lie, we're all kind of in a scarcity mindset. We are terrified. There is the risk that we will lose everything if we push too hard. And that's what the city is terrified of as well, right? And so the unions are giving it some serious thought because what they want is to make sure that all of the jobs, not just in construction, but like once they start turning those spaces into distribution centers, that even the distribution jobs are union jobs. If they get that's a huge win. And their plan with getting that plus environmental protections plus a track for Black youth in the area. And if they push too hard, we might lose everything. So the unions are giving it some serious thought. There's a coalition meeting. People are getting ugly,
I
like
bet.
really, really fierce, and calling each other all sorts of stuff. And how dare you abandon us? And why are you trying to cost us this? And I think you might have met BK Woodson. He's one of my favorite spiritual leaders in the Bay Area, and he's part of the coalition, and it is a predominantly secular coalition. And all BK does is say, "I want us to pause for a second. I want us to actually close your eyes and picture the people that brought you into this campaign in the first place. Why is it you wanted to be a part of this? Picture their faces, picture their names, picture their families. There are real human beings that motivated you to be a part of this. We're just going to sit in silence for a couple of minutes and, picture those folks." And at the end of those couple of minutes, he said, "All right, let's take a deep breath and let's come back to this conversation." And everything shifted. He didn't say a single religious word. He didn't need to. He didn't want to. But what he was doing in that moment was reminding them of who they were. And what I loved about that is, to me, that was like the best pastoring that man has ever done. And that's in a lifetime of some pretty good pastoring. And he didn't do it in a way that demanded anybody be any religion or any belief system other than to remind them that they were all people who cared about the thriving of the community in West Oakland that has been underinvested in for generations now. And that's what I love at this work at its best. That's what I love seeing.
I mean, it's just dealing with facts, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what we have inside, right? And that's what we know when we get that feeling, when we know something is true and has that kind of imminent value, right? Yep.
That's right.
We're going to just take a short break, everyone. Just wait a few more minutes while we listen to some of our sponsors, and we'll be back here to talk with Shonda Rani Jha.
Witness Filipino activist groups in Seattle, Washington, stand in solidarity with their Kasamas, comrades, in the Philippines, where Ferdinand Marcos Jr., son of the deposed martial law dictator Ferdinand Marcos, was recently elected president. The triumph of Sara Duterte, daughter of brutal authoritarian President Rodrigo Duterte, as the new vice president, continues the legacy of dynastic regimes throughout Philippine history. The threat that a Marcos Duterte renaissance holds is palpable for many Filipino activists who have fought the political corruption these two families embody for generations. Seattle Filipino organizations answer the call to action as they pressure their government officials about the United States' militant culpability for these terrors and remember their own martyrs, victims of the long arm of Marcos Sr. Learn more at kasamafilm.org. That's K-A-S-A-M-A film.org.
Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Krista Lee Crane, and you're listening to us on Transformation Talk Radio. Welcome back. We're here with the fabulous Shonda Rani Jha, and I want us to tap into some of this larger body of work that they have. Shonda's fifth book with Chalice Press called Rebels, Despots, and Saints will release on MLK Day next year in 2023. Can you tell us a little bit about this book? What was some of the inspiration around it, and how's it going?
It has been so fun. So like you said, it's my fifth book, and this is the one that I feel like this has been decades in the making without me even realizing it. And really, in some ways, it came out of the fact that, you know, the turf on which I get to organize, Oakland, over the past 5, 7, 10 years, I have watched some of the most beautiful social justice actions and gatherings and practices showing up in organizing spaces where people very intentionally acknowledge their ancestors and invite us all to bring our ancestors into the spaces. And what struck me over time was how much that reduced burnout among people who were dedicating their lives to social justice. Just mm-hmm. having that connection to something greater than ourselves, something that preceded us. It was just life-giving in hard times. And that was true for people who were religious, but also a whole bunch of folks who aren't religious at all. And so I feel like I have two groups I work with. I have the folks who are like deep in the work, and then I have the folks who know that there's something wrong in the world, but don't quite know where to start to change it. And so Rebels, Despots, and Saints is really my love letter to organizers mm-hmm. and an invitation to practices that will keep us from burning out, that will keep us engaged in the work and feeling supported. And it's also my letter of encouragement and empowerment to the folks who want to be a part of change and are maybe a little nervous about getting started. So Rebels, Despots, and Saints is about ancestors. The subtitle is The Ancestors Who Free Us and the Ancestors We Need to Free. And what was super fun about it was getting to create connections for folks with even the very complicated ancestors that we have. Sometimes we have complicated relationships with our ancestors because some of them did some harmful stuff. Some of them did some messed up stuff in order to survive. Some of them did messed up stuff to get ahead, to even do harm to other people because they didn't care about other people. some of us have complicated relationships with our ancestors because our ancestors have been taken away from us. There's a whole bunch to wrestle with and to grieve, but also we've got some hidden stories about our ancestors. There are ancestors whose stories didn't get passed on to us because they were the troublemakers. And in some ways, those are the stories we deserve and need. And also, we've got cultural ancestors and social justice movement ancestors and spiritual ancestors, all of whom were also troublemakers in the best sense of the word, who have wisdom to offer us. And no matter how hard things are getting for us, no matter how hard the terrain is, we have people to turn to who have survived hard things and have things to offer us in this moment. And I think that whether we're religious or not, rituals can be really healing, really comforting, really encouraging, really grounding. And so each chapter has rituals for individuals and for groups to practice to connect with different types of ancestors in healing ways. Super excited about it coming out.
I love that because I think about even just like the simple thing of how I travel, which in most of my travel is for work, but like I have my traveling altar.
Yes.
That goes with me everywhere I go. Like I have a couple little Buddhas that are always in every bag that I travel. Like there's just things that I just do.
And here's the thing. Buddha is an ancestor. Mm-hmm. We don't, I mean, he was a real person. He walked the earth. He's like got a ton to offer. He's an ancestor.
And then I think about the things I keep from like my grandmother, who's had just a huge influence on my like self-reflection of goodness.
Yes.
And I mean, I hear her voice every day.
I love that.
And like, it's just so interesting that, I mean, if we could just say, hey, folks, just tap in.
Mm-hmm.
But mm-hmm. That doesn't mean anything to some people. They're like, tap into
right.
what?
Right.
Like, and so that idea and like the trained socialization of denial.
Yes.
Of a deeper connection is been one of my most challenging experiences as being an educator for 16 years.
Yeah.
Is that I need them to learn, like my big agenda is to provide information and processes that allow them to create less harm in the future.
Yep.
That's why I still teach. But that's not in my job description.
It's funny the way what we're actually there to do and what the people who hire us think we're there to do are very different a lot of the time.
Yeah, I mean, and I feel very lucky. I mean, in January, it'd be 10 years at Cal State East Bay, which is wild. I know. And just thinking about the kind of like ripple butterfly effect of not even just good. I don't want to say good intention, but like goodwill through acts.
Yes.
And how teaching provides that, how, you know, our consulting work and like in these DEI spaces can, you know, the done well, it is supposed to do that.
Yeah.
And so when you think about like all the things that you see and that you're even talking about in this book and like the things that you experience in your work, when you think about what you bear witness to,
mm-hmm.
like what are some of the biggest challenges that you see and what are some of your hopes for us?
You know, it's interesting because I think a lot of the people who hire me to do DEI work, and I bet you've had the same experience, diversity, equity, and inclusion, they think they're hiring me specifically to help them get better at, say, race or gender or LGBTQ inclusion. And what actually motivated them to reach out to me is a conflict that they don't know how to navigate. Mm-hmm. Right. And so it's interesting because race is often part of that conflict, but in some instances, it's the presenting problem. And there's a more foundational, who do we understand ourselves to be relative to each other? It's been fascinating to me. I have lots of technical information to share. I think it is good information, and it sets up an organization to do better with policies, practices, processes. And I think that makes a world of difference for the future of the organization. But what people don't realize is they're not actually hiring me for the future of the organization. They're hiring me for a crisis, maybe not even like a big crisis, that's in the present. And that part of the work has very little to do with the very important systemic work I love doing, and has an awful lot to do with helping reground people in who they are. What they have to create space to allow others to be, and where they need to hold fast and where they need to let go of things.
I mean, it's so nice listening to you because you're speaking my language, but also like in the sense that when people talk about DEI work, they think about a committee or a statement or review HR policies. I'm like, well, it's more than that.
Yeah.
I always ask folks, well, how did I get here? What created the need for me to be in this space? But then the other piece too is it's like this work is tapping into community psychology, mental health spaces.
Yes.
This is that, you know, kind of para psychology field around this work is about social emotional processing.
Yes.
Like, and it's so like coaching clients, like I worked with an organization actually based out of Oakland. For now we're going on our third year. I coach their staff and I do trainings and, you know, really working with folks for me, that's a movement building activity.
Yes. Yeah. I think of it as part of my organizing work.
Like we have to take care of each other. And I will say like one of my greatest teachers in that lesson is Dr. Reverend Liza Rankow, right?
Yes.
Who was the founder and executive director of One Life Institute. I was on the board, you know, with her for a minute, but she taught me so much. And, you know, she's one of our elders.
Absolutely.
So it's called up Dr. Liza.
Yes. Such a fan.
Yeah. Yeah. She's good people.
As well as one of the foremost experts on Howard Thurman.
Yep. And I know she has a book coming out soon. And I'm going to come on and talk about it.
Yes.
So these dynamics, right, that you're seeing, like you're talking about like folks are trying to deal with the presenting problem. I really like how you said that, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it's like when people, and I really wanted to like talk to you about this, like when people are resistant to seeing themselves in this work, and especially, so for me, my clients are like, you know, county governments, social justice organizations, and social behavior health groups across the country. So service-based, people-centered, ideally, work.
Yep.
And so part of that is like helping folks figure out who they are. But like when you get that resistance, like what are some things that come up? Like,
yeah. You know, it's interesting because I only use trainings as a way of getting people into that kind of headspace. Like people think they're learning technical skills in a training, and most of the time what I'm doing in a training is helping people get to know who they are in a safe and non-threatening way. I suspect you do the same thing. There's a workshop I often do around culture and conflict. And there are a million different icebergs of culture out there, right? The one that I am madly in love with, I haven't seen one quite like it. It's got surface culture, the stuff that's above, you know, the waterline that we all, we love, you know, the food and the clothes and the, you know, writing and all of that stuff, the fun part of culture. And then they've got shallow culture, which is the stuff that is unarticulated, you know, the values that we hold that aren't universal, that are cultural, but we don't always name them as cultural values. We just name them as values as if they are universal. That might be our relationship to time or the way we understand how children should be supervised in group settings. And the stakes in those are higher because we don't always talk about them as cultural values. But then below that is something that they call deep culture. And that's the stuff we don't even realize is culture. So it's not just we don't say it out loud. Like most of us, people have heard jokes about Indian Standard Time or people of color time or, you know, all sorts of versions of non-white time. So somewhere in our collective conscious is this narrative that white people show up to things when the clock tells them to, and people of color, people of the global majority, have a different relationship to time. That's sometimes true, it's sometimes not. Sometimes a stereotype. Sometimes it's because, you know, I've been at meetings in India where people show up 3 hours late, and it's not because they lost track of time. It's because traffic is so bad that 3 hours was what it took instead of the half hour it should have. So that's something that, like, if you talk about it, people are like, oh, right, different cultures have different. But our assumption initially is, here's how everybody relates to time. When we're told about it, we're like, oh, right, different people. And we may think some ways of doing it are better than others, but we're aware that it's cultural. The deep culture stuff is the stuff we're not aware isn't universal. The stuff that we think is universal, we don't realize it's a cultural value at all. And that's where the greatest tension shows up, because really, even when we're told, you know, some people relate to death and dying differently, it doesn't register, it doesn't make sense to us, because we have this sense that everybody relates to death in the same way, that that's something that's human rather than cultural. And I think it's so great to get to talk about that, because those are the moments where people are like, oh, I just thought the other person was being difficult. They see the world completely differently than I do. What do I do with that? Oh, I just assumed I was thinking the right way and that person was divergent. It turns out I'm seeing things from a particular location rather than being the norm. I love those moments in a training, because while I am providing technical information that will help them engage in conflict through a different lens, it's also helping them get to know who they are. And for people who are part of the dominant culture, for them to get decentered isn't just, hey, don't be in charge of everything. It's realizing, oh, the way I was shaped is one of many ways.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge paradigm shift for some folks. And for those of us who are people of color who have been living in spaces that are driven by the dominant culture, to realize, oh, it's not that I've been getting this wrong. It's that I live in a world that acts like one way of being is the only way of being. That can feel comforting and empowering.
It, you know, I found so much grace in my resistance, and that's what I heard from you in the sense, but like, my resistance is my acceptance of myself.
Yeah.
Because there ain't nothing wrong with me.
Yes.
And I'm not going to let anybody tell me that there is.
That's right.
But I can't say that I always felt that way.
Right.
And of course, the earlier years in my life, like, I would say, like, were so difficult as being a queer, Black, white, and Indigenous person.
Yep.
And coming out at 13, right? Mm-hmm. And being like, you know I'm a little different than everybody in this household.
Right.
But there's got to be, like, some place out there for people like Crystal.
Yes.
And so, you know, one of those places that I found was in Oakland and with you and with all of our other comrades. And there's been other places in the world, but there are places where when I walk outside, it is a common knowledge that there might be resistance.
Yeah.
And people don't participate in the resistance.
Yep.
That's a big difference from places where we come from, Michigan and Ohio.
Yep.
In that regard, where it's like, people will participate in the resistance, like, and not even consider that I have a human heart.
Right.
And that is something that has just been, and I think will consistently be a spiritual and heart test for me, because my tolerance is very low for things like that.
Yep.
In the sense of exposing myself to what I will say, quote unquote, fuckery.
Yeah. Yep.
I know better. I have to keep myself strong for this work, and I can't be exposing myself to ignorance when there's no safety for me there.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean I don't have love in my heart and I, you know, no ill will, but like, I can't trust you.
Right.
To not harm me.
Right.
Also just facts. Right. Like, something that, you know, probably this is past like 7, 8 years of, has been a solidified belief, and but belief, yep. but also that influences the way in which I keep myself safe.
Yep.
Right.
Yep. And it's interesting because I think a lot of people think that any of us who are committed to nonviolence, I think there's this narrative, there's this this misunderstanding that we're walking through the world naively being like, no one will hurt me. And that's not like nonviolence is an intentional chosen path, and it's not a naive one. Mm-mm. And it's not one where we seek out opportunities to be harmed. Strategically, sometimes there are moments where we intentionally say that is a significant risk and it will serve the movement. And we might take those risks for that reason. But I do think that part of staying resilient for the work of nonviolence is also making sure that we're not squandering that energy. I heard this amazing trans author who talked about how he didn't love the closet metaphor for queer and trans folks. He said what he loves is the snail metaphor. And he said, what a snail does is when it is life-giving and helpful to move themselves forward, they come out of their shell and they do their thing. And when there is legitimate threat to their safety, they go back in their shell. And his point was, you do not have to be ashamed of taking care of yourself, of protecting yourself. It becomes harmful when all you do is stay in your shell and you can't go out into the world and be fed and connect. But to be aware of your surroundings, to be aware of what the costs are, and to take care of yourself, we should not be shaming that. And I thought that was so beautiful as a metaphor.
I love it. I haven't heard that before. And it makes me, you know, the thing about the importance of our work, but just like that, you know, I'm included in my work.
Yes.
Because like, I'm not going to give up and I'm in this until we're done. Yep. For this cycle, you know? So like, yes. I'm not going anywhere. I have an unwavering commitment to what we're up to. Yep. And that can be isolating. Because not everybody lives in that space. Even those who are our comrades, like that, it's quite a space.
Yep.
That I think even kind of mirrors some of the like ways in which folks who are clergy are like trained in the sense of like, you know, like that's, I feel like that kind of level, yeah. of like, I'm in service and stewardship. I don't know what you're talking about. Like, this is my path, right? Like, yes. this is how I get to share love with the world. And that's kind of intense.
It is.
People.
It is a lot of pouring out.
You know, and I think it might like scare folks, but I think it's my existence demands that they see themselves as well.
Yeah.
When we don't hide, then it's harder for them to.
Yep. Yep. That is absolutely true. I used to joke that this was what made me a hard pastor to be a congregant for is the same thing that makes me hard to date.
Yeah.
all the time. I'm like, all right, how do we get better? How do we keep working? How do we make the world a better place? How do we show up for each other better? There's rarely an off switch for me in that.
Hey, I'm so glad that we have that in common.
Yes.
You know, and it's the love for life that makes us this way.
Yep. Yep.
So lastly, but it's a multi-part question. If we could have one, and because I love you, I'll give you two wins in society, what would it be right now? And what do we need to get there?
All right. I love that because I don't know. Did you ever get to work with Pat St. Ange, maybe when she was at AFSC?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I was at an event with Pat. Pat, who's an Indigenous rights activist and who is partnered to one of the great heroes of the civil rights movement in the Bay Area. They are just such the social justice power couple elders. I was at an event that Pat was speaking at maybe 4 years ago, and she said to everyone in the room, most of whom were labor justice, you know, they were union folks, they were community organizers, and they were not there because they cared about the environment. They were there because they cared about workers. But what was interesting is she said, you know, everyone in this room, there was a time where your ancestors didn't understand the land as belonging to them, but understood themselves as belonging to the land. And she said, part of the work for us today is to get back into that kind of relationship to the land. It will transform all of the eco-crisis issues that we are facing. And I think that has stayed with me ever since. I love the idea of reclaiming that very different relationship to the land, because I think that that's what leads to a change of our relationship to each other. Because when we understand we belong to the land, we can also understand we belong to each other. And I think connected to that, I was just at the Hella Feminist exhibit at the Oakland Museum, and they had an excerpt from one of the earliest documents that was about womanism from the, oh, I just blanked on the pronunciation of the Combahee Collective. I didn't get that right. Is that right? Back in like, what, 72?
Mm-hmm.
And they talked about how when we achieve liberation of Black women, we will have dismantled all of the systems of oppression for everybody. And so mm-hmm. I see those things as very connected to each other.
Yeah.
If we engaged in a world where our public health strategies started with what will help Black women thrive, we would address all of the equity issues. If our public policy strategies were what will help Black women thrive, it would change all of our policies around immigration, around incarceration, around gender justice, including trans folks. So to me, those are the two, and they go hand in hand. In some ways, they're the same win. If we could shift our relationship and our sense of belonging to and with the land, and if we could reimagine a world where we prioritize the thriving of Black women, I think that would create a world where all of us would get to live into the fullness of our being.
And that is, you know, that's not all I hope for, but it is a big piece of it, right? Because it is that disconnection that keeps us moving at a pace that is too slow for the change that needs to happen for not us all to just survive, but to actually thrive.
Exactly.
So I just want to say thank you so much, Shonda. I adore you. I love you. Thank you for spending time with me and introducing yourself to my listeners.
It is such a gift to be with you anytime I get an excuse to. I am so grateful for you.
Thanks, love. Join us next time. I'm your loving host, Dr. Krista Lee Crane, and this is Us.
Might you have some time to read original material or explore new art? Check out the open access journal, The Beauty of Black Creation. Our purpose is to emblemize the creativity and brilliance of people within the African diaspora. Our goal is to publish an interdisciplinary collection that shows the contributions of our innovation that is bold, relevant, and rooted in our innate wisdom. We envision having an online publication that includes visual arts, poetry, essays, and profiles on what we have and continue to create for the world. Tell us your story, share your creative works, be bold, Black, and beautiful. Learn more at thebeautyofblackcreation.org.
Thank you for listening to Us, Critical Conversations on the Challenges of Our Time, with me, Dr. Krista Lee Crane, on transformationtalkradio.com. Together, we bring positive change to the world through critical conversations about social justice issues. Tune in every fourth Wednesday of every month at 3 p.m. Pacific with me, Dr. Krista Lee Crane, and my guests. For more information about Dr. Krista Lee Crane, please visit KristaLeeCrane.org and PreventionAgenda.org. Happy listening.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and do not necessarily reflect the views of the station, its management, or advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.